Hey, everybody, it's The Takeaway. Today, we're going to check in with the investigative team over at Trump Inc. This week, they're looking into the Trump Organization's questionable business dealings in India. Also, we're continuing our series focusing on women's health by zeroing in on concerns around pregnancy and reproduction. But first, we'll start off with the upcoming census. We're going to look at how Asian Americans might be disproportionately affected by a controversial question about citizenship. All that and more on The Takeaway for Wednesday, March 28th, 2018.
Wondered how do they allocate money from the government for the cities and the states? Let me tell you how we can all make a difference just by taking time and filling out the U.S. Census.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. Good to be with you today. We begin this hour with news out of the Trump administration that surfaced late Monday night. The Commerce Department, under Secretary Wilbur Ross, formally announced it'll comply with a Trump administration request to include a citizenship question on the 2020 census questionnaire. State officials immediately blasted the news. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is now preparing a multi-state lawsuit. And by Tuesday afternoon, California's Attorney General Javier Becerra filed a lawsuit over that decision. Here's AG Becerra in a press conference on Tuesday.
If we don't do an accurate census, when you're talking about a several percentage point or even a few percentage point differential between the actual count of people in the country and what the census reveals, could translate into several million people not being counted. If those individuals are distributed in particular states, those states will lose out on not just a representation, but on the resources that their taxpayers are contributing.
Advocacy groups also spoke out against the decision. They say, in the current political climate, with fears about deportations, many immigrants may now be too afraid to take part in the census. And that's deepening concerns about underrepresentation among Asian Americans. People of Asian descent living in America are at risk of being undercounted due to language barriers, poverty status, and housing stability. And according to calculations from the 2010 census, one in five Asian Americans live in census tracts that are considered, quote, hard to count for those reasons. Daniel Meyer came to the United States with his family from Macau in 1977. He's undocumented and currently lives in Hayward, California. He's never taken part in the census as an adult and says the new checkboxes raise even more questions about how his data could be used.
Who's to say how responsible that data collection would be? Who gets to hold controls on that? Would it be used as a tool to help communities, or would it be used as a tool to target individuals or communities based on the responses?
We participated in the census as a family. The recent one, 2010, I believe there was no question about citizenship, so we had nothing to worry about.
That's Jong Min Yoo. Came to the United States with his family from South Korea when he was just a year old. Today, he is 38 and undocumented. He says the new citizenship question won't deter him from participating, but he can understand how it would intimidate some immigrant families.
I think other people would be really afraid to answer that question, especially if they, you know, they don't want to lie to the government. I just hope that the American public understands that citizenship is not easy for undocumented immigrants. Maybe the better question would be, on a census, would you like to have American citizenship one day?
John C. Yang is the president and executive director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. He also sits on the Census National Advisory Committee on Racial, Ethnic, and Other Populations. And he says census data is integral in how states operate and how communities are supported.
Census data is used in a wide variety of ways. First and foremost, it is used to determine the members of Congress and how many members of Congress are in each state. Then the census data is used to break that down even further within the state, because states will use that to determine how the districts are formed. But perhaps just as importantly for all of us in the United States, census data is used to determine federal funding. Approximately $675 billion in federal funding is allocated based on census data. I think the last thing to point out is that businesses use census data to a great deal. They determine where their next store is based, where the next branch of a bank should be opened, based on population demographics that come from the census data itself.
So what about this particular change? The census will now explicitly ask whether or not a person is a U.S. citizen. Has that question been included on a past census?
That question has not been used on the census since 1950, so it has been 70 years since any form of that question has been used in the decennial census. And that is very threatening to our community, to the Asian American community, but to many minority and immigrant communities. Because anytime you impose a question like this, it will create fear in the community about what that means. Now, one thing to remember about this is that this question has not been tested on this decennial census. Now, the Census Bureau is known for its statistical accuracy. It's known to be an expert in collecting data. And it is constitutionally mandated. It is constitutionally mandated that we count all people in the United States, not just citizens, but all people. And this is the cornerstone of democracy aspect of this. From that, we can determine representation in the states, representation in Congress, and we determine the allocation of resources. So absolutely, this question can have a very significant effect on representation of our various communities.
So there are currently 9 questions on this form, but if this one is added, there will be 10. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. That's correct. At least in the earlier testing that we saw, and I sit on the National Advisory Committee for Race, Ethnicities, and Other Communities for the Census Bureau, where they have typically landed is there's typically about 9 or 10 questions. And so any addition of a single question is a significant addition to the overall feel and look of the census. And especially in this particular environment where immigrants are already feeling like they are under attack, adding questions like this without testing is just potentially going to really undercut and really create fear and suspicion in the community when we already have a barrier that we need to overcome with respect to counting.
So there is another side to this. The Secretary Ross, how is he justifying this?
That's right. So Secretary Ross is justifying this on the basis of a request by the Department of Justice. Specifically, the Department of Justice suggested that this question was necessary to enforce voting rights. Now, we all know that since the Voting Rights Act of 1965 came along, there has not been this question, and there has not been a need to have this type of question to understand how the districts are allocated, to understand how to enforce voting rights. So as a result, it really makes us wonder as to why this question is being added. It has not been necessary in the past. Vinita Gupta, who is a former head of the Civil Rights Division for the Department of Justice, has gone on record as saying that this is not necessary. And so we have to wonder why this is being asked at this point in time.
So from the perspective of the Asian community here in the USA, what's the major concern regarding voting?
Well, the major concern with respect to, I guess, the citizenship question is that that is going to dissuade Asian Americans from participating in the census. We have already seen in certain surveys that are being done, even by the Census Bureau, that anytime there is a fear of government intrusion, a fear of immigration, people just shut down and they do not want to respond or participate in these surveys. So what we are potentially seeing is that a census that has a citizenship question will dissuade them from answering. Now, what that means in the long run is that Asian Americans will not be represented in the count in the census, and they will not get the political representation to which they are entitled, whether it is in Congress, whether it is at the state and local levels.
So I want to make sure to, for everyone who's listening to us, to point out that even before the addition of this question, undocumented populations may have been uneasy participating in the census because of fears of deportation and immigration officials getting to them. Would you agree with that, or do you think that that's inaccurate?
Oh, that's absolutely right. Even in the 2010 census, which was a different environment, there was a large effort that was made by the community to make sure that everyone responded to the census. Now, in this current environment, we know from our work that everyone is fearful of any type of government intrusion. And let me be clear about this. It's not just immigrants or undocumented immigrants. It's even citizens. So citizens here in the country, when we talk to them about various issues, already are fearful of any sort of government person that is coming to their door and asking them questions. Maybe it's because they have immigrants that are in their household. Maybe it's because they employ immigrants at work. But the reality is that there is a large population that is out there, undocumented, document, citizens, non-citizens that are fearful of this environment.
Historically, Asian Americans have been undercounted by the census. Is that right?
That's correct. And we should be a little bit clear. In the 2010 and 2000 census, Asian Americans were counted in approximately the right numbers. Now, I say approximately because when we delved into those numbers, we realized that there were still significant undercounts in certain communities, like in Long Beach and certain pockets of California. But it takes a whole of government, whole of community effort to make sure that we are fully counted. And that's the problem that exists today.
There's such a shift towards technology right now, towards counting people potentially online if they were to submit a form through the internet. Could that also affect the Asian American immigration population count?
I think the use of technology is going to be very interesting, and it could affect the count. On one level, the fact that you can use technology and fill out the census form on the internet may be good because it allows people to maintain some anonymity with the government. On another level, as we all know from the various issues that have come up with respect to hacking, with respect to internet privacy, I think people are scared and fearful of submitting personal data across the internet. And that's just something new that we have to navigate. And that's another reason, not to compound on all of these reasons, but that's another reason that having this untested question is so concerning, because we already have a number of variables with this current census, Census 2020. To add another variable that we don't know the effects of can have a dramatic effect that will not be good for the community at large.
So let's look at the bigger picture. What are your biggest concerns about this decision? What are the real on-the-ground implications of a lack of representation stemming from a potential undercount in the census? Okay, if you can give us some very specific examples, please.
Well, the specific examples go to our members of Congress, whether our members of Congress will reflect the communities that we represent. And if we have an undercount, then people will not see the Asian community or the Hispanic community or other communities for the fullness and the richness that they have. That's number one. Number two is if there's an undercount of the Asian population or a miscount of the Asian population, federal funding that is available to various communities will not be allocated correctly. Already, the Asian American community, there's a large diaspora of different communities that have different needs. If we don't have an accurate count, those resources do not get to the accurate places. And lastly, is if we don't have accurate census data, again, to the extent that businesses are making investments, they will not invest in the Asian community because they do not see the return on investment because the numbers aren't there.
The numbers are critical in this case. Thank you so much, John C. Yang, the President and Executive Director of the Asian Americans Advancing Justice. You also sit on the Census National Advisory Committee on Racial, Ethnic, and Other Populations. Thank you.
Thank you.
We reached out to the Department of Commerce about their decision to add this question to the 2020 census, and they sent us this statement. Secretary Ross found that the need for accurate citizenship data and the limited burden that the reinstatement of the citizenship question would impose outweighs fears about a potentially lower response rate. You can read the full statement, where the department also comments on their effort to count hard-to-reach communities, on our website, thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino.
Donald Trump Jr. landing in Delhi to promote the U.S. First Family's business interests in India. Starting Tuesday, he will meet investors and business leaders in Mumbai, Gurugram, Pune and Kolkata, cities where his family has real estate interests.
That's an Indian newscast from just last month when President Trump's son, Don Jr., traveled to India. It was a trip that was originally intended to focus on foreign policy, but instead mainly dealt with the Trump Organization's business interests. And as it turns out, there are more Trump projects in India than anywhere else outside of the United States. And that's why it's the focus of the last two episodes of WNYC's podcast, Trump Inc. Reporter Anjali Kamat has been looking into the Trump's business ties in India for the past year. She found a trail of corruption, even though many of Trump's projects are just getting started.
Soon after Trump became president, soon after he won the election, actually, in November 2016, I started to see some news reports about how, you know, India was where the Trump Organization had the largest number of overseas licensing deals. And then about 9 days after the election, he started receiving some international visitors. And one of his earliest visitors was a delegation of Indian businessmen. And these were three of his business partners on real estate deals in India. So people started to raise these questions about the line between business and politics.
So to be fair, Trump has been fairly upfront about his connections in India. You can hear him here at a campaign event in 2016.
I am a big fan of Hindu and I am a big fan of India. Big, big fan. Big, big fan. Let me start by stating right up front that if I'm elected president, the Indian and Hindu community will have a true friend in the White House that I can guarantee you, that I can tell you. I'm involved in two massive developments in India, you probably know.
So he's talking about a couple projects here, which are his projects in Mumbai and Pune, which are ongoing. The Pune project is actually one of the only ones that's completed. The Trump Organization has five active projects right now in India. But what doesn't often get talked about is that before these five deals, there was a deal before that that got struck sometime in 2010. But I also went to India to look into the paperwork and found some paperwork about this deal. And what's really interesting is that the partners on that deal, you know, drew up plans for this proposed tower that at the time Trump said would be one of the most luxurious buildings in the world. But the plans ended up being so fraudulent that they were ultimately revoked. The permits were revoked. And a few months later, Don Jr. comes to the city and meets with the highest elected official in the state to try and get him to reinstate the permits. And he doesn't do it because he says it's blatantly illegal. So that was the first project in India, and so it was a total failure.
We actually have some sound of Don Trump Jr. in India.
I'm here as a businessman. I'm here,
absolutely,
you know, not representing anyone. I'm here, and I've been coming to India for over a decade, so I understand the market. I understand the mindset.
Are some sections of Indian industry willing to bend rules when it suits them?
Well, listen, I think there's an entrepreneurial spirit here that is, you know... Again, it needs no further explanation.
Okay, so I'm going to read in between the tea leaves. What did he mean when he said that entrepreneurial spirit?
Well, the announcer's question in that interview was really asking him about corruption. You know, India is a country which is ranked on the World Bank Group's Ease of Doing Business report. India is ranked 181 out of 190 countries. And that's because getting a building built in a city like Mumbai requires so many different permits. And in order to move the process along, at each point, typically you have to pay a bribe. But what's interesting about this is from Don Jr.'s visit to India just last month, February 2018. And he's now here, he says, as a businessman, he's not representing anyone. But in a lot of the news interviews he did, a lot of the media coverage of his presence, he's constantly referred to as the son of the U.S. president.
Led by Donald Jr. Trump, son of the U.S. president. Add to this the excitement of the unmatchable offer. First 100 buyers of Trump Tower get to fly to New York to be hosted by Trump Jr. himself.
To hear that, it makes my eyebrow go up a little bit. So, is it clear that the Trumps are violating any laws here, or are they just managing to skirt the lines a little bit of what's allowed by a sitting president?
It's not clear what laws are being violated, but it does raise a lot of questions about conflicts of interest and a lot of questions about the Trump's way of doing business in India. Because what the Trump Organization and what Don Jr. say publicly is that we are not allowed to do any more deals. President Trump said there would be no more foreign deals. You know, we have to remember that all of the Trump's deals in India, what they're telling us is that they're all brand licensing deals. So what the Trump Organization's lawyers have said in the past is that they are merely licensing the Trump name and that they don't have any financial stake in the project. But one of the things I found in my reporting that is really interesting and I think raises a lot of questions is just how involved Don Jr. and the Trump Organization has been in these developments. You know, one way of asking the question is Donald Trump's position as president good for his business? The other way of asking the question also is, how is the business affecting the presidency? The weekend before Don Jr. arrived in India, major newspapers in New Delhi were covered with full front page ads saying that, you know, Trump has arrived. Are you invited? And anyone who could put down a deposit of about $39,000 to $40,000 on an apartment before a certain date would have a chance to have dinner with Don Jr.
You're offering a dinner date with yourself to all your new buyers.
Well, but if I didn't, I'd be the first person in the history of real estate to not go meet with their buyers, right? So, but that's the problem. Because my father happens to be in politics, there's always a catch. It must be because of this. It's like, wait a minute. I'm functioning as a real estate developer. That's what we do.
Sure, many of these people might be genuinely interested in buying a Trump condo and curious about meeting someone like Don Jr., especially since he also happens to be the son of the U.S. president. But the question that ethics experts are asking is this selling access to the presidency? There's four projects which are still under construction. So the number of permits that are required, the number of pre-construction units and completed units that will continue to be sold. I mean, this is a story that will continue to unfold over the course of this presidency.
Anjali Kamat is a reporter with the Investigative Fund. She's been looking into the Trump's business interests in India for WNYC's podcast, Trump Inc. The second episode of the two-part series is out today. Anjali, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Last Sunday, a fire ripped through a busy shopping mall in the Russian city of Kemerovo in Siberia. The Winter Cherry shopping mall had a bowling alley and a movie theater popular with children. So far, authorities are reporting 64 people died, and that number includes dozens of children. On Tuesday, thousands of Russians protested outside the local municipal building. They're frustrated by a lack of official answers. There are rumors that the death count might be far higher than what the government is letting on. Joining us now is Anna Nemtsova. She's Moscow correspondent for the Daily Beast. Anna, welcome.
Thank you.
So far, Russian officials are reporting that 64 people died in Sunday's fire. Have those numbers been updated at all?
Well, the latest report I saw said that 64 are dead and 14 are missing. So 14 people are still missing, and we also saw reports yesterday that said 67 was the death toll. We are talking about up to 80 victims. 41, at least 41 of these people were children. Some came from villages, some were visiting Kemerovo, a big regional center, for the first time. It was their first field trip to the city. They came to watch a cartoon at the movie theater, which was upstairs in the mall. And apparently the door of the movie theater was locked when the fire started, and the kids were trapped in that movie theater. The main questions that people have were why the door to the movie theater was locked, why people were not evacuated from the roof of the cinema theater for 40 minutes, and what happened to the firefighters, why it took them so long. So there were mistakes on all levels.
There are a lot of people in Russia right now who are saying that this deadly fire is actually a symptom of a far bigger issue. They're pointing the finger saying that there is corruption in the city. How is the backlash being taken over there in Russia right now?
You know, today more than ever, people realize that there is the vertical of power. And that everybody at every level, all the authorities, they delegate the power, the decisions to the top. And therefore, the government chose a reactive way of treating this issue. And for a while, nobody declared the mourning. People came out yesterday, hundreds of people in Moscow. But before that, there was a huge protest in Kemerovo. Kemerovo is a city full of hardworking people. It's an industrial center. They work in harsh weather conditions. Many work in mines. So in that city, the governor was ruling the region since he has been in power since 97. And a few months ago, people talked about the end of his term, but the Kremlin kept him in power, probably because of the presidential elections. He was always elected with more than 90% of votes in the region. And today, the local people are very upset about him because he did not show up at the site right away after the tragedy. He did not come to the protest. The protest lasted for many hours, for more than 5 hours yesterday. And the government did not show up. After a few hours, Putin flew over, and we see a video on YouTube where Vladimir Putin walks out of his vehicle, and he did not come to the crowd. He came to a group of people, and some men asked him, so is this investigation going to be transparent? Because people want everybody who was guilty to be punished. We want transparency. We want to know the truth. And he promised, he said, yes, you will know the truth. But in Moscow, the reaction was different. In Moscow, it was much more politicized. The protest, there were banners that said, we are all trapped in the zoo. We are all locked up in the zoo. People felt that it is everybody's trouble. It's not just Kemerovo's trouble. The entire Russia is suffering right now from this trouble.
Anna Nemtsova, Moscow correspondent for The Daily Beast. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino with you for the next week. And at the end of the hour, we'll continue our series, Taking Pains with Women's Health, and answer your questions about the state of maternal and reproductive health care here in the U.S. But first, we want to take a few minutes to look at the flurry of activity when it comes to abortion. Over the past month, state legislatures have passed or are considering restrictive bans against abortion in places like Mississippi, Ohio, Iowa, and Kentucky. They're teeing up a major legal battle in the courts. It's all part of a wave of optimism amongst anti-abortion activists and conservative legislators who are emboldened by President Trump's promise to appoint conservative judges. Cynthia Suhu is co-director of the Human Rights and Gender Justice Clinic at CUNY Law School. She also writes about these issues for the Reproductive Rights Prof blog. Cynthia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Can you first give us a rundown of the most notable abortion legislation from around the country and where they stand?
I think the first thing to understand is that in some ways this is something that's not new. For the last probably 10 years, we've seen a flurry of anti-choice legislation each state legislative session. I think what's interesting in 2017 was, according to the Guttmacher Institute, about 63 new restrictions on abortion were passed. And this is actually the most significant number of anti-abortion restrictions that have been passed since 2013. The other thing that I think is notable is that the type of bills that were passed. Because a lot of the bills that we saw last session and we're seeing currently in this legislative session are really targeted to take aim at the current Supreme Court precedent and to try to roll back the current standard that was established in Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
So put differently, they're not just trying to make change on the local level. So people in New York, San Francisco, Seattle need to watch out for what's happening in places like Mississippi, Ohio, and Iowa, because that will have a ripple effect around the country.
That's right, because what they're trying to do is they're really trying to pass laws that are designed to go to the Supreme Court to challenge the current abortion standards.
So if we could talk about some of those specific states. In Mississippi, what is going on?
Yeah, what's going on in Mississippi? Well, I mean, the thing to keep in mind is that since 1992, the Supreme Court has said that that women have a right to choose to terminate their pregnancies up till fetal viability. And that means that the states cannot ban abortions prior to viability. And that's commonly accepted to be about 24 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so what Mississippi did last week, is it passed a bill that would have prohibited abortion at 15 weeks.
15 weeks.
Yeah. And so once it was passed, it was immediately challenged. So a court stepped in, and right now there's a temporary restraining order that prevents it to go into effect. But the other thing that we've seen that there are other states that have laws that are even more brazen. So right now in Iowa, there's a law that would prevent abortion after 6 weeks. And Ohio went even further. They right now have a bill that's pending that would prohibit all abortions, period, without any exceptions. And it would also define an unborn person as a person for purposes of criminal homicide statutes.
Prosecuted for homicide if she chooses to exercise her right to end her pregnancy.
Yeah. So this was clearly set up to try to challenge the existing abortion statutes because it's clearly unconstitutional. And the amazing thing about the Ohio statute was that Ohio passed a six-week ban last year, and their governor, Governor Kasich, who is an anti-choice politician, actually vetoed that law because he said it was unconstitutional. So I don't think that there's a chance that the bill is going to move forward, but it's clear that anti-choice legislators are trying to either they're trying to make a statement to appeal to their constituencies, or they're trying to just get as many bills in the pike that they can so that they can challenge the existing Supreme Court's precedent.
So we see what's going on the state level all around the country, obviously with the goal of taking these cases to the Supreme Court. Any idea when they might actually make it to the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, it takes several years, right, for a case to actually get all the way to the Supreme Court. Right now, a lot of these laws, there's a temporary restraining order, which just means that the law cannot go into effect until there's actually a case, right? Then there actually has to be a case. Then it'll go to the appellate court, and then it may or may not go to the Supreme Court. And so the thing to keep in mind also is that the Ohio law may get vetoed. I don't know what's going to happen with the Iowa law. And the other thing is the Supreme Court doesn't necessarily have to take these cases, right? So the Supreme Court actually, in 2016, lower courts actually struck down six-week bans and 12-week bans, and the Supreme Court declined to review the cases. So, you know, going back 2 years, the Supreme Court said, you know, the lower courts were right, and six-week bans and 12-week bans are unconstitutional, and we don't even need to hear the case.
So if you're a woman in this state, say Mississippi, for example, and you want to have an abortion before or rather after 15 weeks, and somehow you manage to make this happen, could you be tried or any way or accused of anything?
Well, you mean if the law went into effect?
Correct.
So I haven't read the specific provisions about, you know, whether there are criminal penalties. Usually, sometimes there are penalties for doctors, and sometimes there are penalties for women. I think, like, what would most likely happen would be if Mississippi banned abortion at 15 weeks, there just wouldn't be any providers, right? The providers would just stop providing abortions at 15 weeks because there's too much risk for them to provide it. And the woman would either have to think about traveling. And I think you have to look at, you know, where Mississippi is in the country and the states that it's surrounded by, because the states that it's surrounded by are most likely to have pretty restrictive abortion provisions as well. Mississippi only has one abortion provider. The states that surround it, I'm sure, don't have many abortion providers. But I think the other thing to think about is that abortion is a time-limited procedure, and women in Mississippi already face a lot of barriers to access abortion. They may not know, may take a while for a woman to know that she's pregnant. She may not have health care coverage. So it's going to take a while to raise the money to have the services. She's going to have to take time off work. She might have to get child care. And then if she has to travel out of state, then she's going to have to make the travel arrangements. It's additional time off from work. Many states have requirements that you have to undergo counseling and wait a day before having an abortion, right? So that becomes a multi-day procedure. The costs get more greater and greater, and it just gets more difficult for people to access abortion.
Thank you so much for talking to us about an issue that's not just affecting individual states, but could potentially have a national impact. Cynthia Suhu, law professor at the CUNY University of New York Law School and co-director of the Human Rights and Gender Justice Clinic at CUNY Law School. Thank you.
Thanks.
It's The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. All this week, we've been bringing you voices on women's health, and we've heard from many of you about how your concerns about reproductive decisions and pregnancy are too often misunderstood or dismissed by doctors.
The entire pregnancy, he just kept telling me that it was in my head and that I was supposed to be in pain.
I kept telling my doctor that I was really sick. I was aching.
Something just didn't feel right. I was told from day one I was just, quote unquote, being difficult, or even that I wanted attention.
People at his office just said, oh yes, everybody's really sick.
Finally got so bad that he recommended I see a GI doctor who diagnosed me with acute chronic pancreatitis.
I was 26 weeks gestation. I delivered that day. She lived 7 days.
Finally, somebody listened to me because the blood work matched what I had been telling them for the last few weeks.
It literally took my daughter's death before doctors took me seriously.
The message, loud and clear for many of you this week, believe me, believe me. So many of you asked us about maternal and reproductive health in the U.S. and how things could be better. Well, today, we want to get you some answers. And Dr. Elizabeth Howell is here to do just that. She's director of the Women's Health Research Institute at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai here in New York City. Welcome, Dr. Howell.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Howell, before we get to our calls, so many people called in this week and they had the same experience. These are women reporting that they felt that they were not being heard, especially when it comes to reproductive choices or pain associated with pregnancy. Are you surprised so many women feel this way?
Unfortunately, I'm not surprised. I think this resonates with many women, and it resonates with many folks who think about maternal mortality and those of us who also focus in on disparities. And this story is familiar. I think Serena Williams' recent story and also in Vanity Fair sort of highlighted this issue that women are often not heard and that their symptoms, they're feeling these symptoms. And for some reason, our healthcare system seems to be interpreting them in a different way. And I think it's something that we really need to start focusing on.
We've spoken about in this series how a lot of medicine doesn't fully understand how, you know, a woman's body works. But the woman herself, who's in that body from birth until death, knows how her body feels. And you would think that a woman like Serena Williams, who's an athlete, who every day focuses on the intricacies of her body, would be trusted when she says something is wrong. Given that, how do women who aren't athletes, who aren't multimillionaires, who aren't famous, advocate for themselves?
Well, I think it's really important. I think the story and the lesson here is about advocacy for yourself and that you don't give up. And that, you know, if you have another voice in the room as well, I think that can be helpful. I think, you know, overall, clinicians try their hardest to do the best that they can. They just sometimes have to be reminded because they're worried about a lot of other things during that period of time. They're watching the baby's heart rate on a monitor. They're doing a bunch of other things as well. And so sometimes they're thinking, especially if there's a complication, they may be thinking about other things with the fetus and the baby at that moment. And so we just have to always remember that we have to advocate for ourselves.
Let's hear from one of our listeners.
This is Becca from Charleston, South Carolina. I'd like to hear your expert speak about the disparities in maternal mortality rates that exist in the United States. Thanks.
There are significant racial and ethnic disparities in maternal mortality in this country, as well as geographic, you know, worse outcomes for women who are in rural areas. The most striking and the largest disparity has been longstanding, and that is that Black women, whether they're born in this country or outside of this country, have a rate that's about 3 to 4 times higher than white women of a pregnancy-related death. This has been something that is very concerning and has been receiving more and more attention more recently as we've heard how we compare to other countries overall in the maternal mortality rates, where the United States actually has rates that have been increasing, while those in other developed countries, the rates have decreased. And we have the highest maternal mortality rate among sort of the wealthier countries.
It's so troubling to hear that. Here's another question that we got, which echoes what we've heard from so many women.
Hi, my name is Adeline, and I'm calling from Palatine, Illinois. My question for you guys is, why doesn't healthcare take postpartum seriously within mothers and offer help and maybe at-home nurses to help with the change of life?
So as a person who studies maternal mortality, this is a really important issue, postpartum care. Now, our caller was talking about support and what's happening. So there are other countries that have, you know, nurse visitors who, you know, visit the home to sort of support women. And there are some programs in this country that also do that for certain women. There's a growing recognition that we need to support women during this time, not only because of their physical health, but we know that emotional health. 10 to 15% of women will have postpartum depression. So support is really critical during this period. And we're learning more and more about different kinds of programs that might be able to be offered to women that can help support them. Things like having a care manager, having a patient navigator help them make sure that they can get back for their postpartum care, et cetera. But returning for your postpartum visit, managing your, if you had gestational diabetes, managing your sugars postpartum to make sure that you don't go on to get type 2 diabetes. There are all sorts of critical things for your health during this period.
I'm struck by that statistic. 10 to 15% will experience some form of postpartum depression. Wow. So There are a lot of women who don't want to have children, but there are some who say that they missed out on the opportunity because of work. I want to read a text message from one of our listeners in Erie, Pennsylvania. She writes, I spent most of my 20s and 30s moving around for my career, and as such, didn't have a consistent OBGYN. I received so much conflicting information about fertility that I missed out in having children. I wish there were more standardization about having certain conversations with women at different times in their lives. So, Dr. Howell, how could we do a better job of communicating with young working women about fertility and their options?
So I think we've known for a while the age, and you know, this is not my field. I'm a person who sort of studies maternal mortality, but I think all OBGYNs could do a better job sort of just talking this through with their young patients and explaining, you know, your fertility decreases with your age, but that is not a factor that has to stop you anymore, that there are just so many more options. When you go and speak to one of these infertility physicians, they get women who are older pregnant with very healthy outcomes. So there are a lot of options now. And I think this field is another field that has just taken off. It's incredible. When I think back to my residency and what the age of the patients that I used to see on the board during labor and delivery, and now when I go to labor and delivery, what the age difference is, it's amazing.
So much has changed. I mean, it's 2018 and medicine is extraordinary at this point, but there's still some challenges. Now, for everyone who's listening right now, is there any thought or message you want to let people know as we end our conversation here about reproductive or other issues?
I think it is really important for us to advocate for ourselves when we're encountering the healthcare system. And that's a really important piece. I think we've heard a lot of stories reminding of us of that today. And the other thing I want to just say is we really need to take care of our nutrition and our diet and optimize our health before we enter pregnancy so we can have the best outcomes for both moms and babies.
Thank you so much, Dr. Elizabeth Howell, MD, Director, Women's Health Research Institute at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai.
Thank you.
Our coverage this week about the challenges women face when they go to the doctor is part of our series called Taking Pains with Women's Health. You can find it all on thetakeaway.org/womenspain. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Duarte Geraldino. You can follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. This is The Takeaway.